Good morning, everybody. It is really good to be back here in person again. I'll tell you, I definitely prefer studying the Bible with y'all together in person. I definitely prefer that over just sitting by myself in my office talking about what's going on. So hopefully you've had an opportunity to see the lesson that we recorded last week and posted up on our YouTube account. We talked about Judges chapter 7 and about the signs that Gideon requests of the Lord, so the signs of the fleece. Then we talked about another set of signs that the Lord gave to Gideon. Remember, the explicit point of the Lord's signs is to make sure that God is getting the glory and not Israel, not Gideon. Right, the whole point is that God tells Gideon, you have too many people with you. We are going to narrow this down some. Right, and famously, Gideon's force gets narrowed down to 300 men. And then God gives Gideon a further sign by telling him to go down to the Midianite camp, and he's going to hear something that's going to give him confidence. So he goes down. And in the midst of this enormous camp, he just so happens to find the one guy who's talking with this his buddy around the campfire about this vision that he just had last night. And his buddy interprets the dream as an Israelite victory over Midian at the hand of Gideon. Right? Obviously, it's providential. Obviously, it's from the Lord. That Gideon hears about this vision and about its interpretation. So Gideon takes his 300 men, splits them into three companies, and sends them in. And then we're told that the Lord causes the armies of Midian to fall into confusion, fall into fear. They turn on each other. They kill each other. They end up running away. And so, that brings us to, I think we stopped at chapter 7, verse 24. Before we continue into the reading, I know we've been over a bit of material without any kind of opportunity for discussion or anything. Did anybody have any questions or comments or anything from last week's lesson that we put up on YouTube? Louise? Yeah. Yeah.
They always said that if they were lapping like a dog, It's just that in their hands they were the ones that he chose because they could see people coming around and more diligent.
More attentive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I mean, that's maybe reasonable. I think the thing that we should note about the text is that God does not tell us why. He doesn't tell Gideon why he is implementing this test. The only reason given is we need to narrow this list down some. And the whole point is that the glory needs to go to God and not to Israel. So it may be that he had that in mind, that, yeah, I'm going to take the 300 guys who have their heads on their shoulders. Or it may be that there was no reason at all and it was just completely arbitrary and the whole point is to narrow it down to 300. Solomon?
I was going to say, because, in Scripture we have, this imagery of dogs being filthy, you can describe.
Yeah, there's that, too. This is evocative language. Yeah.
So I was thinking, they're lapping like dogs, and it's kind of a providential thing that they would do that, because they're afraid, and that was kind of why.
Yeah, they're on alert, as it were. Yeah, and I think that's an interesting connection that this comparison to a dog is not flattering at all. Yeah, not from our standpoint, and definitely not from an Israelite standpoint.
If you look at the animal perspective, just watching this stuff in Africa, a lot of times animals get attacked when they're in the water.
That's where the ambush happens.
Looking for that lion,
Yeah. So, but yeah, I think it's useful to remember that comparison to the dog is really insulting. Because you remember that In Hebrew, dog is a euphemism for male prostitute. Wayne?
Well, all these comments are pretty good. I've heard them.
Yeah.
And I used to preach it too.
I'll
raise my hand on that. But then reading the text, here's one of those gestalt things where the lines go almost to meet, and we tend to fill the gap between.
Yeah.
Okay.
Judges is pretty good about that.
There's nothing there that tells you that, as far as I can see, that they picked up a water with their hands. It says that they lapped like a dog, but that's all it says.
There is some debate in.
They would assume that, but there's no gap that we tend to fill in. Maybe that's true. It would have to make sense, but there's nothing there in the text.
There's some debate in the literature about exactly what's the distinction between getting down on the knees versus lapping like a dog. I don't know that it's really material to our understanding of what God's trying to do. But it's an example of us seeing little gaps and we think, oh, that gap is small enough that I can fill it. And that, the book of Judges is really good at giving us, again, just enough rope to hang ourselves with. So, all right. So, yes, Devonna. Ah, yeah, it does. There we go. So that detail is given. It's not a little gap for us to fill in. That gap was filled.
That is human nature.
It is, yeah. Some of the other stuff, and this was stuff that we talked about in the video, there are some things where we want to supply things that the narrator of Judges has not supplied, like the rationale for, why pick the guys that are drinking this way instead of that way? The thing that the text explicitly tells us is that it's so God gets the glory, right? We want to narrow that number of men down so that Israel does not try to take the glory for themselves. That's the reason, right? Anything else that we try to fill in is speculative and sometimes ends up trying to give the glory back to people instead of giving it to God. Jason?
Well, one of the interesting things about it is in the event of the way that we look at it, God does not leave any chance to anyone believing that it could have been anything other than his hand.
Exactly.
If it had been even close to even numbers,
that
it could have gone either way. If they had too many, then he would say it. He made it so lopsided.
It's absurdly disproportional. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that is an excellent point. We're going to see, I don't think up to this point we have seen a specific number put on the Midianite army. We're going to see a specific number once we get into chapter 8. And it's over, well over 100,000 people, right? Who do you think you're going to take 300 men up against over 100,000? And we're not talking like the Spartans or something where you've got some, some little narrow pass that you're defending and there's some natural advantage where you catch them at a choke point. They're encamped in a valley. There's no way that 300 men take that many men, that many Midianites. It absolutely all points to God. Now, we're going to see what comes of it afterwards. Let's go ahead now and get into our text for today. We'll see how far we get. Judges chapter 7, verse 24, and we're going to read a little into chapter 8. Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and capture the waters against them as far as Beth Barah and also the Jordan." So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they captured the waters as far as Beth Barah and also the Jordan. And they captured the two princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. And they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeeb they killed at the winepress of Zeeb. Excuse me. Then they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeeb to Gideon across the Jordan. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, "What is this that you've done to us, not to call us when you went to fight against Midian?" And they accused him fiercely. And he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer? God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you? Then their anger against him subsided when he said this. All right, so at this point in the story, right, Midian has already been defeated. And based on what we've read in Judges so far, at this point in the story, we might expect things to go a certain way, right? We might expect the next words to be something like, you know, a notice about Israel having rest for X number of years, right? Now that the Midianites are defeated. But that notice is delayed by a few complications in the story. And what we just read was the first complication in the story. You'll remember that Gideon initially called out the northern tribes west of the Jordan. So he, when he goes, let's see, back in chapter 7, I think. Who did he call out? Here we go. Chapter 6, verse 35. And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, and they too were called out to follow him. And he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they went up to meet him. All right, so he's called out Manasseh, Asher, Zebulun, Naphtali. I don't think Issachar was mentioned. Yeah, Issachar was not mentioned. But those are the tribes that have come with him. He did not call out Ephraim, but now he does, seeking to cut off the Midianites' escape. He wants them to go out and capture some of the river crossings to keep the Midianites from escaping. So Ephraim accomplishes this, at least in part, right? They capture and behead two of the enemy princes, these guys named Oreb and Zeeb. The meanings of their names are raven and wolf. So they catch these two guys, raven and wolf. They behead them. And then they cross the Jordan to join in the pursuit of the remaining Midianites and to present their heads to Gideon. But besides presenting the heads, they also present an accusation. Right, they feel that Gideon has snubbed them by only calling on them in the last minute. Why would they be mad about this? What reasons can you think of why Ephraim would be mad that they've not been called out to battle? They want their hand in the victory because, what do you get from victory?
Spoils.
Rena?
What about just pride?
And pride, yes. So, I mean, of course, we all know the old saying, to the victor go the spoils. Right? And remember, this is, by the way, one of the central issues of what's going on in Gideon's story, is the matter of pride, like Rena mentions. Where does the glory go to? It goes to God. Why would Ephraim be upset that they're not called out to begin with? Well, it may be they get cut out of some of the spoils. It may be that they lack some of the prestige of the victory. And in fact, and I think this is probably the way we are supposed to understand their response in the midst of this honor culture in antiquity. Because Gideon, look at Gideon's answer to them. He doesn't really even talk to them about spoils. He's mainly trying to assuage their pride. Right? What have I done now in comparison with you? Right? He's buttering them up. He's flattering them. Right? Who is Gideon compared to Ephraim? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer? Right? So just the leftover grapes sitting on the vine or on the ground in Ephraim, that's a better harvest than the whole grape harvest of my entire clan, he says. Right? God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb, you know, raven and wolf. What have I been able to do in comparison with you? So Gideon answers them again with flattery and with self-effacement. And what's Ephraim's response? It works. they, they are assuaged. So we definitely get the sense that their pride, their honor, is a big part of why they are upset at not being called out initially. And Gideon doesn't discuss spoils at all, although that certainly would have been in view. Excuse me. So Ephraim is assuaged. And we see something about the way that Gideon deals with people. And he's pretty smooth in dealing with this. This is kind of a brief section. Any questions or comments on that before we move on to the next part? Wayne?
Okay, the military maneuvers. I know this must stay, but anyways, you call up your initial frontline troops to initiate the battle. Okay, you get them in a certain position. And what was evident here is they had a frontal attack, but the 300 broke their lines and caused them to flee. Right there, you know, they have a way to get out. They fled.
Yeah.
Because they fled, they had a way to get out.
Yeah.
But what you do is you call up your reserves to encircle and capture them, which is where Ephraim called it. They called in the reserves to encircle them and capture them.
Yeah, cut them off, keep them from escaping.
This is a blocking maneuver.
Yeah.
And this is something you would do after you initiate the battle.
Yeah.
So it makes perfect sense that if this was laid out this way.
Yeah.
Because it works.
Yeah. Now, but that brings something to mind, though, because the initial attack, 300 men against over 100,000, remember, the whole point of that is that it doesn't make conventional military sense.
No.
Well, you see what hold on just a second. You see what Gideon has done now? He has, we just spent a big part of chapter 7 making sure that the glory goes to God because we've got some unconventional military tactics going on. And now that has turned on a dime. And now Gideon has returned to conventional military tactics to try to finish things off.
Actually, it's conventional anyway. And the reason for it, because there's a surprise element. They didn't know they were coming. They were sitting there just, hemming and hawing and just enjoying themselves. And all of a sudden, here's this attack. Out of the blue, all these people. And it looks like, we have to take it from the perspective of 300 men, but there's 300 fighters. Usually when you have an attack...
I got to cut you off just a second. First off, because we only have 15 minutes left, and also because it's something that we addressed in last week's video. So I'd encourage you to have a look at that because that is one of those gaps that we talk about, right? Like, we want to fill in that, this obviously, they responded in panic because they saw these fires spring up suddenly. The text does not tell us that. Go back and watch last week's video. I'm gonna cut it off there, though, for lack of time, and since we've already discussed it. John, I think I saw your hand or heard you.
The verse before they were talking about the water, the lapping dog, or drinking water like lapping dog, right? They captured these watering places.
Yeah, I mean, strategic points. Yeah, where they can cross. Yeah. Okay. Let's continue into the next passage. Judges 8, verse 4. And Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over, he and the 300 men who were with him, exhausted yet pursuing. And he said to the men of Succoth, "Please give me loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after Zebah and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." And the officials of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your army?" So Gideon said, "Well then, when the Lord has given Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." And from there he went up to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered. And he said to the men of Penuel, "When I come again in peace, I will break down this tower." Now, Zebah and Zalmunna were in Karkor with their army, about 15,000 men, all who were left of all the army of the people of the east, for there had fallen 120,000 men who drew the sword. And Gideon went up by the way of the tent dwellers east of Nobah and Jogbeha and attacked the army, for the army felt secure. And Zebah and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zebah and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic. Then Gideon the son of Joash returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres. And he captured a young man of Succoth and questioned him. And he wrote down for him the officials and elders of Succoth, 77 men. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, "Behold, Zebah and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted?' And he took the elders of the city, and he took thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson. And he broke down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city." All right, we're definitely throwing a little twist there at the very end of that, aren't we? We'll get to that. So we said that the first complication in the story, that we've not yet reached the part where Israel is given X years of rest. The first complication was this matter with Ephraim. The next complication involves the towns of Succoth and Penuel. You might remember both of these locations from the story of Jacob. These are both important locations in his life. Penuel is the place where Jacob wrestled with that mysterious man overnight, an angel of the Lord. Succoth is the first place that Jacob settled after escaping from Laban and coming back to the Promised Land. And now Gideon comes to these two towns with his exhausted men, and he asks them for aid. And here we are reminded of the situation with Sisera in jail. Sisera flees to Heber's tent, thinking that he will receive hospitality and sanctuary there. Likewise, Gideon ought to be able to expect hospitality from the people of Gad, right? Because that's what tribe we're looking at here. Right? Succoth and Penuel would have been somewhere in this area here, in the tribal territory of Gad. And remember, the unity of the eastern tribes with the rest of Israel was kind of a big deal at the end of the book of Joshua. You would expect hospitality from them, but instead they turn him down. All right, now we'll talk about Gideon's response in just a minute. First, the story turns to these Midianite kings, Zebah and Zalmunna. They have lost 120,000 men due to the confusion. All right, so you know, we're told that Gideon was initially up against 135,000 men with his 300. And 120,000 of those died in the confusion. Again, this is unquestionably from the Lord. These guys have 15,000 men left. They are fleeing. They are approaching safe territory, the Midianite homeland. They feel secure, and it's at this point that Gideon overtakes them, still with his 300 men. Zebah and Zalmunna flee. Gideon captures them, and the remaining Midianites are again thrown into a panic. And so Gideon takes these two kings in tow, and he returns to Succoth and Penuel. He had promised to beat the elders of Succoth, which he does. What did he promise to do to Penuel? He says, "When I come back, I'm going to do what? I'm going to tear your tower down." What does he do to Penuel? He tears their tower down. What else does he do?
He kills the men.
He kills the men. Right, this is a whole lot like, well, actually, let me put it to you first. What do you guys make of this? Yes.
And he comes back and he's not really in
peace. He's not in peace. That's an excellent observation. He said he's coming back in peace. As far as they're concerned, he's not being very peaceful.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead, Rena.
What I don't understand is with those exhausted soldiers, why they lack compassion.
That's a really good question.
I'm
and
talking
the
about compassion. I mean, if I saw those soldiers, even if they were nothing to me, I'd still feel sorry enough.
Yeah, so we should absolutely establish this, that Sukkot and Penuel are absolutely in the wrong for refusing Gideon and his men their hospitality.
I mean, just compassion, even if you don't agree with the politics of their war. Like, if I saw ragged, exhausted soldiers, I would give them something.
Yeah.
Gideon comes back for revenge.
And Gideon is coming back for revenge. All right, we'll hold on to that just a second. John,
the reality is they probably didn't think the 300 were going to win. So they don't want to help the 300, so the 125 come back and they have to deal with them.
Yeah, perhaps they are hedging their bets here and they're expecting some retaliation from the Midianites.
We're assuming that, but that's human nature.
I mean, that's kind of the way that they talk to Gideon. Are Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should help you? Like, there's a calculated response going on here.
So they helped the 300.
Right. There's clearly some kind of calculation going on here. So we should say just outright that Sukkot and Penuel are guilty of refusing to show hospitality to their fellow Israelites. Gideon, a judge appointed by God for the task of defeating the Midianites. Right. There's no way that you can turn Sukkot and Penuel into heroes in this story. But what do we make of Gideon's actions? Luis said revenge. And I think that is a useful way of looking at this. Because where do we get the idea? Well, I don't know if I want to open it up for just broad discussion or how we want to do it. But where would we get the idea that Gideon is justified, that he has the authority to go into Sukkot and beat all of their elders? Now, he's not a member of the tribe of Gad. He's not, in fact, he's not even an elder in his own clan. Remember, he told the angel of the Lord that back in chapter 6. I'm the least in my father's house. Now he thinks that he has the authority to go and beat the elders of another town and another tribe. Maybe we could make some kind of speculative case about why he would be justified in doing that. It would not be based on Scripture. We have to say that. It would be speculative. But then we get to Penuel. And not only does he break down the tower, but he kills the men of the city. And the way that the narrator of Judges presents this to us should remind us of chapter 1, where Judah captures Adonai Bezek, and then we're just told kind of offhandedly, yeah, they cut off his thumbs and his big toes. Right? Like that's a perfectly normal thing for people to do. Oh, of course, yeah, just a matter of cutting off his thumbs and his big toes. Judges has presented us again with some casual violence, and we are left to wonder what to make of it. It's just simply and briefly reported, except this time, right, whereas Judah's casual violence is directed at one of the pagan kings, this time Gideon's violence is directed at other Israelites. And again, we have to wonder, where does Gideon come off being judge, jury, and executioner over the town of Penuel? I mean, you could make some cases for certain types of sin, perhaps for enough guilt coming on a town that they would be condemned to death. But for turning Gideon down with bread, I don't know. Maybe we could draw some comparisons between Penuel and Sodom and Gomorrah. Those might be stretches.
But nowhere does God give Gideon direction. He does this on his own fleshly.
Right. And that is something that we should keep track of, by the way. When was the last time that we saw the Lord acting? I want us to keep track of that, because Gideon's story is not quite done yet. And we'll see. By the end of this, we'll see that the text goes for quite a while without the Lord explicitly acting in the story. Go ahead, Louise.
I was reading it, the slides back into his earthly pride and, like Rena said, pride and everything, that he's, you know, he it just flies all over him that they didn't get bread.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he just kind of slacks off because he wasn't really in the beginning.
Yeah. So that brings us back around to this question that we asked last week about Gideon's actions. Whenever he presents the army with this plan, right? We're going to take our torches and our jars and our trumpets. We noted nowhere are we told where that plan comes from, right? And he tells the army, whenever you go in, shout for the Lord and for Gideon. And so we have this question. Is this an example of Gideon beginning to slip into pride? We didn't have a clear answer for it then. We don't really have a definitive answer for it now. Although we've got now a couple of points where, again, we're questioning, all right, what's the motive behind Gideon doing this? By the end of the chapter, we will have a clear answer to both of those questions. But I'm glad that you've noticed that, Louise. Because now Judges has invited us twice to wonder about Gideon's pride. And we've been told explicitly from God at the beginning of chapter 7 that that is one of the central concerns, is Israel's pride. Where does the glory go? We're going to see where it tries to go by the end of the chapter. We are pretty much out of time, so I'm not going to try to squeeze in the execution of Zeba and Zalmunna. We'll have something to look forward to on... We've got a beheading to look forward to on Thursday. So make sure y'all come back on Thursday, and we'll behead Zeba and Zalmunna. And then we'll see what happens to Gideon, because this is... I've been trying to have us notice things as we've been going through the story, because if we've not been picking up on these things... What happens at the end of Judges chapter 8 seems like it just comes out of nowhere. It seems like Gideon has completely turned on a dime, when in fact he's probably been moving in this direction at least since the time that he was encamped outside of the Midianite camp. So, thank you so much for your questions and comments and your kind attention this morning. See you on Thursday, Lord willing. Oh, and before I forget, remember part of our COVID mitigation strategy is that in between Bible class and worship, we are all stepping outside to give the building a chance to air out, get your cooties out.